Hello, Thomas.
Hello.
And thank you for participating in the second podcast
Thank you very
on
much.
academic writing. I kind of wish that we had like an we should have a jingle starting off, right? It should be like the chatter of keys or something. Anyway, okay, so we should for today, I imagine that we should talk about we've labeled it the practicing writing. Practicing knowing, and I think that's sort of suitably bold. I'd like to talk about initially practicing writing and how you can kind of approach that and how you can get better at knowing through writing. And then I'd like, once we've done that, to move into more general discussion of what is of an academic argument, as it happens, not just in a paragraph, but also in a longer text. I think that'll be kind of a helpful extension.
Yeah,
Because of
that's
course all those paragraphs can go into something, right? So that's kind of my that's my hope. I hope you're on board for that.
a great idea.
Okay. So you have a pretty particular vision, I think, of how you practice writing,
Yes.
right? Last time we talked about that it was like you get better at it by doing it. But I know you have more to say than just rinse and repeat. So would you elaborate on your ease? How do you practice writing? How do you get better?
I think the idea of practicing knowing and practicing writing is a really good distinction to keep because if you want to practice your writing, if you want to become good at writing, you have to distinguish that from the problem of knowing. You can't show up to your writing session not knowing and hoping that working on your writing will fix that for you. There's some truth to the idea that you can use writing to become more clear about what you don't know and to guide your thinking and so forth. But at the same time that you're struggling with your knowing, you're not going to make yourself a better writer. That's why I encourage people to distinguish the act of making up their mind about something from the act of trying to say it or write it with a receiver in mind, an audience in mind that we want to discuss this with. So when we make that distinction, knowing and writing, it's for the purpose of distinguishing two different difficulties. One is making up your mind, and the other one is writing it down.
I think as you say that, I'm also thinking it makes a lot of sense. I think sometimes people confuse it, right? Sometimes they say, I need to write in order to learn. And I think that's totally viable. But in that case, my response is always, well, in that case, you're not writing for someone else. You're writing for yourself. And you should, in principle, just keep that to yourself.
That's right. And I mean there's an important part of not keeping it to yourself that's also part of learning. So I need to write down what I think is true, along with my justifications for thinking that is true, with a reader in mind that I respect in the sense of having enough knowledge about the subject to correct me if I should be wrong. It's only when I'm writing in that mode that the actual confrontation with the reader, where the reader then gives me feedback, for example, because I'm writing well, because I have a strong prose, that when they critique me, they're not critiquing my writing anymore, right? They're critiquing my thinking on the matter. And that's why you need to be a good writer, because then you're not learning that you can't write or that you're not clear. You're learning that there's something you've misunderstood if you have, right? Because somebody else who understands what you're saying is now able to give you information that you didn't have. So you realize you got a certain company wrong, you realize you got a certain theory wrong. So that confrontation becomes much more interesting if you're writing well, if you're writing clearly.
Yeah, and I think that's actually very often a frustration for readers of academic assignments that you read something and then you have this sense that what the writer is trying to say, what the student is trying to say is sort of obscured by their writing. And that's such a shame, right? Because it leaves you in doubt. Sometimes you're thinking there is genius here. But it just doesn't, I just can't get it in the writing. And then you sometimes become conservative in your reading of it.
Right.
And that's super unfortunate for people with great ideas, but not necessarily that great of a writing
Yeah.
style. So say you want to become better at writing. How would you think about like what should you I remember when I was a PhD student, you told me that I should do piano lessons in my writing. And I know you also have an idea about how you could use feedback with your peers and revisiting the same key sentences. Could you kind of elaborate? How would you talk to somebody about who wants to get better at writing? Like, what kind of a practice would you recommend?
Right. So the piano lesson metaphor, I just had a session with my son on this. He plays in a band, and they decided to do a new piece, and so he was struggling with the new melody. And one thing I noticed was that he would sit down at the piano, he would practice for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then he would stop. Sometimes he would stop in the sense of going back to a different piece that wasn't the one that he was struggling with. So he would still be sitting at the piano, but he was no longer trying to solve the problem that he was facing. And this is why the writing moment is so important. This is why those 27 minutes or 18 minutes or 14 minutes, whatever you give yourself, is so important. What you do is you set yourself a time limit. You make sure that the task for that time limit is specified so that you're not allowed to move on to a different task. You're not allowed to say, now it's getting too hard. And once I challenged him just to say, to sit there for half an hour, and you can't do anything other than keep trying to play these notes that you know is the melody that you're trying to learn. Obviously, I mean, I think you know where this is going, because otherwise it wouldn't be a story with a moral. He eventually just cracked the code. He realized what it was that was causing him the difficulty, what he was doing wrong that made it sound wrong. And it wasn't some fundamental issue. It was just a question of there was a misunderstanding in one of the notes that he was reading, which was flat or sharp or something, right? So he figured out what was going wrong. He figured out the timing of the piece in a much better way. And so that's why I really stress, give yourself a moment in which to try to say it, but then also when that moment runs out, and even if you haven't succeeded, stop. So that's a kind of a contract that binds both ways, right? So that you will struggle, but the struggle will end, and often you'll find that the problem is solved. If not, then of course you try again, but don't keep going, because then you'll get stuck and frustrated.
So I think what you're saying there is like the act of writing is kind of a self-contained learning moment, right? If you revisit it, you will get better. Now, I've tried to learn to play the piano, not with any like discernible success. And my sense is that it's because I also tried to learn to play the bass, also not with great success. Until I talked to somebody who is a good at playing the bass, and he said, well, it's because you're not doing it right. I mean, so he was basically telling me you need to get an instructor to help you do the chord, like do the chords or do the scales in this way. That'll make you better. So what you're like, sometimes the act of doing something repeatedly can help you. Sometimes you need feedback. I mean, and you're claiming that if you're just right for the same allotted amount of time, you will get better.
Yeah. Feedback, I mean, comes in lots of different forms. And obviously, if you have somebody that knows the instrument that you're trying to learn and is willing to observe you and then correct you and say, well, you're doing it wrong, try this, that's excellent
It was a gift,
information, right?
yeah.
That's obviously something you want to have. Another kind of feedback would be watching what somebody else does, and then trying to emulate it. And of course, here it's really important to make sure you pick somebody that is doing it in a relatively straightforward way, not in some quirky or really different way, some sort of a brilliant kind of way, right? You just want to make sure that you're doing it in a standard way. Now, here, the beauty of the academic environment is that you've got so many things you can read to watch how other people write sentences, right? There's no shortage of texts that you can look at. And so I'd really just encourage you to do that, to take other people's work and see them as exercises. Now, one of the things I always challenge people to do is to read things out loud. And so do take another text of somebody take something from the required reading, read it out loud, see how it works when it actually passes through your entire sensory apparatus for deciphering a text. But of course, in the workshops and in the online peer grade system, This is one of the tasks, is take somebody else's attempt and read it out loud. And then tell the student, tell the writer what they how that was, how it felt to read it out loud. So I mean, I'd say use all of these opportunities you can for feedback, and mainly observe what people, when people suggest doing it differently, try it. And if it works for you, if that solves the problem, then do that. If it doesn't work for you, then it's either because you didn't quite understand the feedback or because there was something wrong with the feedback, which happens. There's no, I mean,
You get that.
yeah.
Yeah. Before we started recording, you talked about how writing and getting feedback in a kind of particular way that you think about is kind of a cheap experience, right? It's an easy way to low cost experience to find out how good your writing is. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I've done a little bit of the math on this, and if you really do this in a minimalistic way, if you do 14 minutes of writing and 2 times 6 minutes of feedback every week following the proposal we have or the offer that we have with as part of this course, you're not putting in more than half an hour a week specifically on that. Moreover, you're doing something that is really part of the class preparation anyway. And there's really three things that you're doing there that are just valuable experiences. They're valuable experiences and they don't cost much in terms of time. That's what I mean by cheap there. So they're not cheap in the sense of worthless, they're cheap in the sense of low cost, right? Which I think is an important distinction even for the course, right?
High gain, low cost.
Yeah. And so what I'd suggest that you think about is, first of all, you're getting those minute, whatever minutes of writing you're putting into it, you're getting that. That is an experience. It is making you a better writer, and it's also helping you experience what you think is hard and easy in writing. So I really think having that experience on a weekly basis is an important one. The next thing that's happening is that you are, and I guess this is a maybe it's like the third and a half thing that's happening, right? So there's a you're exposing yourself to criticism from your peers. Now you're getting that actual feedback. So in that sense, you're really open to it. You're going to listen to what somebody else thinks of your expression, your writing, your ideas, and that's really good. But of course, that's also part of the experience of writing because you're writing for the specific purpose of opening what you're thinking to criticism. So it's really already that experience is part of the writing as well. And then you're getting the feedback, and then of course you're giving feedback as well. And the act of watching somebody else do something and trying to figure out how they could do it better is such an important experience as well in terms of sharpening your own eye for ways you can improve. So that half hour to an hour of exercise, of training every week, is worth a great deal. And what it's one of the reasons that I've always said that no matter how much time you've budgeted for a course, right, some of it will be for reading usually. And then if you haven't budgeted any time for writing, like if you said, I'm going to put in this much time for this course, right, and I'm going to show up to all the classes or a certain percentage of the classes, maybe that's what you've decided. So you've made a certain optimization of that. And then you've decided, I'm going to put in this many hours of reading the course material for the class. And then, of course, this many hours of group work, this many hours of actually doing the assignments and so forth. My suggestion would always be to take 20% of your reading budget and turn it into a writing budget instead. And that's just as a kind of quick point of departure. You will get more out of everything if you write, or sorry, if you read less and write at all than if you read more and don't write at all. So those 20% would be a good way of doing it. Of course, it would be even better to take 20% of your reading budget and add it on to your preparation. But these are always decisions that you're making based on your level of ambition and your feeling of how difficult this is and how much effort you need to put into it. So.
That's sort of a nice speak. Last time we talked about how you could make a joke, right? That's kind of a nice joke to be made about what you just said in terms of ambidexterity and exploration and exploitation. which people who take the course will get, but
Yeah.
everybody else won't. But
As
that's
long as it's
great.
not on me, I'm
It's not
happy.
on you. No.
Yeah.
It's just a, it's just it would be a way of talking about what you just said. I just want to there was one thing you mentioned about that I think it's really worth underscoring, right? This idea that when you're writing, you are deliberately opening yourself up to criticism. And that's kind of that's the virtue of academia in a sense. And I remember in my youth reading a book called Beginner's Mind, which was like a Zen book.
Is it Watts?
No, it was Suzuki, I think.
Suzuki. All right.
Suzuki,
Good
right?
enough.
So
Yep.
Beginner's Mind, anyway. But I think that's actually kind of a nice way to think about it, right? That's what we're trying to do. In everybody, we're trying to cultivate a sense of being in a learning process. You should always have a beginner's mind as you approach something. I read a ski book later that said being a greenhorn is good for the soul. So I think that was kind of the American riff on
Yeah.
it. Anyway, okay. So practice, we can all agree, is the way to get better at something.
If I may add something, because we're talking
You
about
should.
practicing knowing and practicing writing. We've talked mainly about practicing writing. And I think it's important to keep in mind, whatever experience you get with this practicing writing, try to figure out how would that become also practicing making up your mind and practicing having a conversation with other knowledgeable people. Obviously, practicing having a conversation with other knowledgeable people is something you'll do in your groups, just with your friends and so forth in the program. And it's a very good idea to set a time limit on those encounters as well. So if you're practicing, when you're ha practicing having a conversation, make sure you say, okay, we're going to talk for the next, and 27 minutes is fine. We're going to talk for 27 minutes or 54 minutes. We're going to have a set of topics we're going to discuss. We may even have a speaker list to go around. So that everybody gets a chance. But whatever happens, when the time runs out, stop. Don't keep going. And it's a very, very good lesson for meeting management generally when you get on in life there, for presentation skills. Make sure that when the timekeeper, the moderator of a forum stops you, make sure that you say, great, give me one sentence, and you have that one sentence to close the presentation, no matter where that happens. And of course, you want to try not to be surprised, so you become better and better at keeping time. But don't let this time constraint be this thing you're always complaining about. Make sure you're learning how to use it, and then everybody pays more attention if you're working within it. So that's one thing. And then, of course, decide how are you going to do this alone. Like, how are you going to cultivate this beginner's mind in the area of making up your mind about something, of taking a set of materials and then deciding what to do with it, deciding what's going on here, what does it mean, how does my expertise come to bear on it, what am I right about in this material that maybe even the participants in the material are wrong about. Because I have some extra expertise, right? So, what is it that I can contribute to this? Is an importantly, extremely important skill to develop, and something you do alone, something you do by yourself, working with the materials. And I would then, of course, encourage you to cash out your decisions about what's going on. So, when you've made up your mind, to cash it out in a sentence you know to be true, not in a feeling of but a sentence that articulates the point that you've arrived at.
I think that's speaking of cheap things to do, right? Low cost things to do. Like every time you finish reading a paper or a book chapter or whatever, taking 5 minutes to make up your mind, that's like 5 minutes well spent, right? Because I mean, lots of reading you do, it just kind of impresses itself upon you, but you don't really get it back out. You don't filter it back through your body.
And there's some simple things you can make up your mind about. Is it good? Right? Is this something? Is this the kind of writing I like? And of course, which is a different question, is it right? Because you could say this person is right, but I'm annoyed with the way I was shown this to be right. I'm annoyed with the argument, even though I think the conclusions are correct and so forth. So make some judgments about these texts, and beware, of course, that they will change. That as time goes by, things that used to annoy you will stop annoying you because you'll start respecting the need for that difficulty in your work.
All right. Okay, so I am we're going to talk about a thought experiment, I think, because of course writing paragraphs isn't all you could do in 27 minutes, right? You could do more. And so I think when we talked up when I mentioned this to you before, you said that this was maybe an overformalization of what you suggest. But I would suggest, and the way that I've used some of your ideas is that 27 minutes is not just a time for writing paragraphs necessarily. What I'm going to suggest doesn't replace writing paragraphs with 27 minutes, I think, but you can do something with 27 minutes that's different from just writing a paragraph. And what I would say is you can use it to write after the fact outlines. So basically, instead of saying, I'm going to spend 27 minutes writing down presenting a justified true belief, you can say, I'm going to write down five key sentences, for instance. That's going to outline an essay or maybe a theoretical argument or how I'm going to analyze an empirical situation. And basically, I can sit down and I can write five key sentences that are going to together be my 1,000 words of analysis, right? One key sentence is going to become a paragraph, and five paragraphs are going to be a section. And I can write those five key sentences in a 27-minute sitting. What would be your reaction to that?
Yeah. So I think one of the worries I have is that once we've said 27 minutes for paragraph writing, if we generalize that to other activities, suddenly I've said 27 minutes for everything, 27 minutes for having a conversation with your friend in the cafe, 27 minutes for cooking dinner. Suddenly your entire day is structured, and a kind of caricature comes out of that that I think it's important to stay away from. So let's start with the idea that if you're going to work in a formalized, structured way on problems, never to plan to work in that way for more than 30 hours a week.
Right? 30 hours a week.
30 hours a week.
Okay.
So as if you're breaking up all your tasks into 14 or 18 or 27-minute sessions on something, that should only cover 30 hours of your of your working week. And of course, one of the main activities that students have is to attend lectures, and they're certainly structured in this way.
Yeah.
So
broken up in 45-minute intervals.
Exactly. So there are moments of your attention, if you take seriously that structure, so you show up and you simply pay attention for the 45 minutes that that's what you're supposed to be doing, or participating in the conversation that you're in the fishbowl. So you're, if that's what your contribution is for the 45 minutes, then you do that, right? And then you relax for the break, and then you do it again, and then. But then, of course, it's very important that the time that isn't structured doesn't suddenly become structured because you think only structure has value, right?
Of course.
And that's an important distinction to make. That said, I like your idea of saying let's take a moment. Again, and you can decide 18, 27 minutes or whatever. And let me think about the five paragraphs that'll make up the theory section of a research paper, for example. And the way I'm going to think about it is I'm going to think, what are the five things that need to be said, assuming that I can support each of them with a paragraph, support, elaborate, or defend each of them with a paragraph. You also suggested something else before we started recording, and that is that that exercise could actually be done as a paragraph. So what you do is you have a super key sentence that's going to summarize the outline, and then of course each of the key sentences you just put them together in a paragraph. And if that flows nicely as one paragraph, that is a kind of abstract of your theory section, then that's wonderful. Then you have a choice to make. Do you want that paragraph to be actually part of the theory section? Could that paragraph become a part of the introduction of the entire paper, where you essentially set up your theory section? And then, of course, the next step, which I also know that you've been thinking about, is take that the further step of saying, well, what if, now we have these super key sentences. What if we just took them and put them all together, strung them together in a paragraph? What would that be? And the answer, of course, is that would probably be an abstract for the whole thing. And that's all well and good. The problem with it is, if you really imagine that structure, you'll have an abstract of about five or six sentences. And those sentences will literally be super key sentences in your paper, which will literally have paragraphs that have key sentences that are the key sentences of paragraphs. So you're starting to repeat structure throughout the system of the entire paper. So you'll end up having 30 or 40 paragraphs, and a lot of the sentences will be very recognizable to the reader of your abstract and your introduction and so forth. So it'll be this great repeat. And at that point, I think you're letting form do too much of the work for you, right? Let form be a space within where the work is carried out rather than the way the work is carried out. Don't let I mean, it's a very important distinction to make, right? The difference between a frame for something, a structure of something, and then a motor or motivation for something, right? So there's something that drives the meaning in your text, and there's something that constrains it and keeps it orderly, right? And if you are letting too much of your drive be creating order in the text, then the text will seem very static. It will, and it will be, I mean, it'll be boring.
I think I absolutely agree. My pushback would be, and this is coming basically from my experience, when I sell students this, when I show them that structure, you can just see like a light going off sometimes, like, oh, this is how you build a long text. And I think that's just, I think sometimes we say that writing has to be good to the extent that we just assume that it'll be good. And I have this metaphor that I borrowed from, I think it comes from ballet, I think, that technique is the dancer's freedom, right? Having a technique is what allows you to improvise. And having no technique means that you can still try to improvise, or in this case, do good writing, it'll just be hard. Whereas if you have a kind of a structure, you can work from there. I want to say two things though. I think the kind of approach that I'm suggesting, which is like a hyper exaggeration of what you would say, I think, is that this would make you, in a structured way, turn around the writing process, right? You would begin your paper, if you were writing a paper, you would begin by writing the abstract, right? You don't just start, you begin by writing the abstract. And then you write, and then you can basically, from there, you can unfold, right? So you always want to start with a big idea, and then you want to elaborate in greater detail. So, for instance, an abstract for a paper or a bachelor's thesis or a master's thesis should be able, I would suggest, in this exaggerated form, would be to say it's going to be 2,000 words, it's going to be 200 words. You should be able to have once, we'll talk about a structure, right? But you should basically have one sentence that summarizes a section in your paper. And the great thing about that, I think, is that it allows you to get feedback on your big ideas rather than on your paragraphs. Because I think the kind of the feedback exercises that you suggest are great. But if you do it this way, if you think about after the fact outlines as consisting of key sentences, then you can get feedback on a whole theory section from somebody in 10 minutes, and they only have to spend 2 minutes reading it. And I don't think we do enough to talk about, like, if I go to a colleague and say, I'm struggling with the theory section, this is what it looks like, does this make sense? Then I'm giving them this big writing thing. I'll drop a paper in front of them, and then they have to kind of work through that whole thing. And I think just saying, these are the five key sentences, assume that I can justify them. Do you still think that this makes sense? I think that's kind of a valuable thing. And I think for it, as you're going to do, for instance, a master thesis, which is going to be this monstrously long document, it's going to be very hard to get feedback if you give people full text of paragraphs of 200 words. But if you give them outlines of key sentences, say, assume that I have the expertise to justify this, then you can actually get really good feedback on your big ideas as well.
And there is a this is really an important lesson in how to approach the text of other people as well, because there's this famous myth about the Oxford tutorial and what happens in one of these,
Which
right?
inspires some of what we do. in the class, by the way.
Exactly. You're sort of scaling that model up, right? And the myth is that there was only ever two questions that was asked. And the first question was, what is the author trying to say? And the next question was, how does the author know? So what is the author trying to say? How does the author know? And if you can make that distinction all the time, then you are in really good shape to think about your text and the structure of your text. Which is why I always, and almost always, and certainly, if a student or a colleague comes to me with a text and they want me to comment on it, I say, well, great, give me the text, but also give me your after-the-fact outline, right? So I want you to tell me what are you trying to say, and then I can help you decide whether or not you're saying it well. And it's often the case that that first step of saying, give me your after-the-fact outline, is puzzling, challenging. It's a move in the discussion that they hadn't been expecting. They hadn't been expecting first to tell me what they're trying to do. They had been hoping that I would tell them what they've accomplished, right? And I think that's a bit of a mistake.
And the reason I'm going to say that I say this is because I think academia way too often is a lonely place, right? It's hard to get feedback. It takes a long time for people to read, so it doesn't happen very often because it's so costly. And I kind of, in my utopian university, I think we're talking more about our processes and the arguments we want to make. And I think finding ways to do that costlessly is really good. I remember as a PhD student sending my supervisor an after-the-fact outline of an entire paper, right? It had taken me a day to put together. And I sent it to him and I said, is this worthwhile doing? And then he could basically see the entire argument as I was going to make it. I just spent a day, like, or half a day putting it together. And then it's such a painless way to get feedback. Imagine I'd written a whole paper and sent it to him and he said, nah, doesn't work. Now, if I just spent the day, it's fine, right? You can say that's a crappy idea. Do something else.
And usually nobody will ever say that about all the ideas, especially if I have 40 different ideas to choose from. They'll say, well, 20 of them don't need to be said because that's really
Obvious
bold, that's really
or.
obvious, right? Five of these ideas are wrong, but you need to find out why they're wrong and then see how that affects your argument, right? That's certainly, and then of course, the positive, which I think one of the things that I'm so focused on criticism that the And I think everybody's focused on the criticism they get. You always have to remember that if somebody's pointing out this is something that needs to be fixed, this is something to be improved, they're leaving a lot of the material standing. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. And okay, so I think we've kind of you inadvertently preempted me, I think, when you were talking about 40 paragraphs or 40 key sentences, because I'd like to talk about the academic paper. And I know you have a very kind of specific way of thinking about structuring of academic papers, which has been really helpful for me in my writing of them. Could you talk about what an academic paper is?
Yes.
Like how it's made, how it's structured, not what it is in kind of a metaphysical sense.
Yeah, so first start with how big is it, right? It's not as big as a book. It's usually smaller than even a chapter of a book. It can be useful to think of it in terms of somewhere between 5 and 8,000 words. And so if you just take that number and divide it by 200, you get a value of, 25, 30, 40 paragraphs. And so it has that many parts. And what that just means is you have space to say 40 things. If you talk about master's projects, you probably have space to say 100 or 150 things. And these, of course, are things about which you've made up your mind. So they're things you know to be true. You have justifications. You can converse about them. And you can support, elaborate, or defend them in these 200-word paragraphs. So I think that's a really good place to start. Then what we have to do is say, there are lots of different things you have to know to write a paper, and there are different kinds of things, right? So the paper, and this is where the sections of the paper come in. Should I just go straight into the outline of the?
Yeah, would
Yeah,
you?
sure.
And again, this is
Yeah.
one of the things when I tell students about this, their eyes kind of light up
Right.
often
I'll
because they're
try
like,
to.
that's wow, is it just that?
Yeah. And it's important to keep in mind, it's in a sense not just that. And this is also that when we're talking about formalism, right? You can't let this outline do the work for you. But it does set up a number of different tasks, and it certainly sets them up in a way that lets you practice writing different kinds of paragraphs. And what you want to do is always think about each paragraph in terms of what am I trying to say? Sorry, that's not actually true. You certainly want to think in those terms. What am I trying to say? But that's just the key sentence. So once you have the key sentence, you can now distinguish the different sections by how am I trying to affect the reader? How am I addressing the reader? What am I doing with the reader?
Not in paragraphs, but in the sections.
In the sections, but every paragraph will do this, right?
Yes.
So in every paragraph, you'll have this form of address to the reader. And then you will have a basis on which to say it. And the basis changes throughout the paper. So you know what part of the paper you're working on based on what kinds of sources you're using. So where are you drawing your information from? What are you invoking in order to support, elaborate, or defend your claims? So always think about those things. So we can go through this in a very simple way. You take the introduction and the conclusion. It's very interesting. What are you trying to do there? Well, you're trying to introduce and conclude. So you're trying to address a reader that doesn't know what you're going to say in the introduction, and you're trying to address a reader that has just heard everything you're going to say in the conclusion, which is a very good way of keeping those two sections distinct but also connected. Because what's your basis for writing the introduction and the conclusion? Your authority as the writer of everything in between, right? So it's because you've written the thing in the it's because you've written all the other paragraphs that you can that you're the person that should be writing the introduction. And that means that your source, your content comes from your knowledge of what's going to be said. So that's an important way to think about that. If we then go through the other sections of the paper, and this is, I guess, kind of arbitrary in the sense that not all papers will have exactly these sections, but most academic papers need to do some of this work, so we may as well think in these terms. And that's the background, the theory, the method, the analysis, and the discussion, right?
You should probably say that again.
I will say that again. I'll say that a number of times, right? So start with background, then you have theory, then you have method, then you have analysis, then you have discussion. Now, some supervisors will move the order of those paragraphs around a little bit. I sometimes think that that's a mistake, and sometimes think that's just convention that varies from field to field. And in fact, there are some cases in which it's exactly the right thing to do. But in most cases, what you want to do is say there's a background section. And if you think of your reader as somebody who shares with you a professional disciplinary knowledge, essentially a theoretical knowledge, if that's what your reader shares with you, then the background section is giving them information that they might not have about the company or the organization or the region or the country or the industry or the product even, or sometimes the management techniques. That you are studying using theories that could study other things of a similar kind. So you're showing the reader, first of all, that you know something about the rough area, empirical region that you're working in, the empirical area you're working in. And you're also giving them useful information that they'll need to understand the things you're going to be saying in your analysis. But the important thing is that it's based on publicly available sources. So what you have here is a text that tries to inform the reader about information that the reader is lacking. So it's providing knowledge that the reader doesn't have based on sources that are publicly available, that are part of what is known or can be known before you collect any data. So if you're drawing on the interviews you've done with the company, for example, you're not writing the background section. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. If you're using privileged inside information that you've gathered as part of your search, it's not background, right? And it's kind of funny actually, because there's a convention in journalism where somebody will say, this isn't even off the record. This is not this, this is It's a version of off the record, but it's not. I'm not even an anonymous source, a high-level anonymous source. This is just for background, which is to say, I'm going to tell you some things, and you're allowed to say that this is how things work in this ministry or whatever, right? But I'm not going to, but you can't say that you've discovered that this is how it works. You can only say this is what one knows how it works, right? So that kind of background information is there. And it's actually that sort of source, your ambient knowledge of how things work in this industry, is fine to use, as long as it's true. And there, so the trick there is to always think of your reader as somebody that is getting information from you, but if they have the same information, so if they are as smart as you are, as knowledgeable and experienced as you are about this industry, then they are probably going to read the section with a kind of critical eye, and really they're trying to figure out if you know what you're talking about, right? So it's also a place to build up your credibility with insiders by showing you know how this industry works. It's an enormously important kind of knowledge to acquire in your studies, and the background section is the place you practice expressing it, right?
I like the term ambient knowledge, actually. I think that's a really good way of thinking. It's
Yeah.
something that should be recognizable. It's something that should be a reasonable way of looking at the world,
Exactly, and it's
but
something
kind of
that,
an uncontroversial.
right, and it's something that is in the environment of the practitioners. So it's the things that practitioners know about this. It's not secret, right? But it is kind of inside baseball, as some people say, right? It's the kind of terminology that outsiders wouldn't understand. It's the sort of facts that outsiders wouldn't be aware of, but that are just a normal part of everyday life if you're in the organization, right? Which, and sometimes your reader will need to have access to that information in order to understand the analysis. But it's not something you discovered, right? It's not something your data shows. It's something that is just known. And so remember that even though it's sort of common sense or trivial or everyday knowledge, right, it's not going to be trivial or everyday to your reader because your reader doesn't run in those circles. Your reader doesn't understand the how things work. So that marks a very sharp contrast to your theory section, because in the theory section, you're going to assume the reader has read everything you've read, understands as well as you understand it. Has formed opinions about it just as you have. Now you may not agree with your reader on all points, but you are going to pitch this to a reader who is at your intellectual level, so you're right at eye level with them. This is why you're normally going to be writing paragraphs that that don't have to support anything, because the reader is going to believe you in a certain sense or disagree with you. Right, so you're either elaborating or defending. And you might say, why are you elaborating if the reader already understands the theory? But there's a sense of elaboration, which is the reader understands the theory well enough to know that if you're going to use this language, if you're going to use these terms, if you're going to apply these concepts, right, then you have to be precise about what you mean. So as soon as you've used these concepts in your key sentence, the reader is saying, okay, exactly what do you mean? So the reader needs you to specify your meaning.
Can I just insert
Absolutely, yeah.
something? So, for instance, the in the course material that we're dealing with, there's going to be a text called "Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma," which basically introduces different ways of solving. I say that in quotes, right? Solving the productivity dilemma. And when we read that, I always say, "Which productivity dilemma are they talking about?" Because you. They don't mention that in that particular reading, but it's basically six panelists debating the productivity dilemma, and I say that they're talking about different versions of exploration and exploitation. They don't mean the same thing when they say exploration. So that's a good example, right? You want to elaborate. Are you on the side, in quotes, of Mike Tushman or Paul Adler?
Right.
Because they're not talking about the same thing, and that's not obvious when you read the text. You kind of have to work a little bit with the text to get that, and you need to elaborate that to your reader.
Right, and exactly. Both positions are legitimate. Both positions
Absolutely.
have good grounding. And unless you make very clear what you mean, there might be some ambiguity about which side you're on. And this is exactly what you need to be doing in the theory section. But just remember, you're talking to a reader about texts that they themselves have read, about positions that they themselves are aware of. And usually, you'll be saying, well, I'm going to imagine a reader that has taken a particular position on this, either agrees with me or disagrees with me. So in each paragraph, there's a kind of rhetorical posture. That is used there. So that's the theory section, and it's important to keep in mind that the just as the overall effect of the background section is to inform the reader, so to fill in blanks in their knowledge in such a way that the reader is now able to see the object that you want to talk about on this background. In the theory section, you want to make sure that the reader is developing a set of pretty specific expectations about how that object is going to behave. Once you've, for example, used the exploitation-exploration distinction, and you've described a certain kind of organization or company or industry in your background section, the reader is now already imagining a particular kind of analysis that's going to show particular kinds of behavior in this in this company, or in this company, or of this company, or whatever in the market, and so forth. And that's what you really want to be doing in the theory section. You want to be very conscious about what expectations are you setting up in the mind of your reader, right? Then when you get, and we'll skip the method section. I always skip the method section. It's much easier to see what it's supposed to do when you get to the analysis, because really what the analysis is supposed to do is to push back against the expectations of the theory section. And we have a, I mean, often we'll say, we want the theory section to satisfy the expectations, or to meet the expectations, live up to them. But in science, what we really want is for the theory section to push back or disappoint the expectations,
The
because
analysis. We want the analysis to disappoint.
yes,
I think you said theory
all
section
right. Well, the
disappoint.
analysis section, right. We want the analysis section to disappoint the expectations of the theory section. Because if it doesn't, then why are we reading this analysis, right? If the theory just got the organization right, what is it we're learning from looking at this company? Well, not very much, right? So there has to be that interesting tension between the theory section and the analysis section. And in ordinary life, if we've spent a lot of time learning a complicated way of seeing the world, if we have an ideology, if you will, or a theory, as we would say in science, then we are going to be very skeptical about information, somebody telling us that that theory is wrong or insufficient or inadequate in some way. And so what we're going to do instead is we will reject it, right? What we'll do is we'll say, there's got to, and in science we say, there's got to be something wrong with the data, right? You must have that. So you, sure, you interview these people, you've misunderstood what they said, or you have not asked the right questions, or they were the wrong people to ask, right? They're biased in some way. And so that's why we have the method section. And what the method section is supposed to do is to build up the trust you need to actually disappoint the reader's expectations. So in order, if you're going to have this forceful confrontation between the theory and the analysis, you need some trust. So in the method section, what you're doing is you're telling the reader what you did to make sure that your data is as accurate a representation of reality as it can be. And that just keep those in mind. So you're informing, you're then building up expectations, you're acquiring trust, and you're establishing trust with your reader, and then you're disappointing the expectations that you set up in your reader's mind.
Okay, so we talked about the background, theory, method, and analysis. And then what does the discussion do?
The thing to keep in mind is that if you have this interesting tension between the theory and the analysis, so where a certain measure of trust is required, so the reader has trusted your data enough to let it challenge their preconceptions about this kind of object, this kind of organization, this sort of situation, then that obviously needs to have consequences. And so you need to, at that point, think about how does the How, what should the reader's mind do in response to this disappointment? What would be a rational reaction to this? That's quite important to keep in mind, that it has to be rational. There's some hardcore sort of positivist scientists who would say it has to be logical, right? So there has to be a kind of a deductive force that passes here. But in most cases in the social sciences, we really just try to imagine the reader's reason, sort of the faculty of reasoning. And then we try to reason with the reader. We try to say, well, aren't these the natural consequences? In a strict sense, there are infinitely many natural consequences of any proposition, and some of them are just not very interesting. So the idea is to make sure that you identify those consequences that have this rational force, that are reasonable to deduce, but are not obvious or so obvious that maybe they didn't even need your analysis to be deduced, right? Because a lot of things can remain the same even in the light of your analysis. So pick the most important ones. And then there's really two kinds. There are changes that you think should be made to the theory on the basis of your analysis, and changes that you think should be made to the practice. And a good way of, I mean, I always, I mean, we can say this, the standard response is to say, well, if we had a theory and it made certain predictions of a market or something, then we would imagine that the theory would have to learn from the market behaving differently, right? And so we would need a modified theory to understand these market activities. But of course, economists don't always do that. So economists, in fact, perhaps more often will say we have this perfect theory of supply and demand, or capitalism in general. We have a perfect theory of how markets work. When we look at real markets, they misbehave, right? And what we call that something, we say they're inefficient. And the solution to that is not to make our theory sensitive to inefficiencies. The actual solution is to make the markets less inefficient by deregulating them, for example, so that
Or
we
regulating them more,
or
right?
regulating some other, but the solution will be a policy intervention, right? And so you can always look at your discussion in terms of what should the reaction be of this tension between theory and practice, if you will, or the theoretical framework, the scientific expectations we have, and the analysis, the object we've analyzed. And then just make some decisions. Do I want to be largely practical, largely theoretical? Do I want to be 50-50? Just always keep in mind that it's kind of a dynamic system. So you always have to make sure that if you're going to propose changes to the theory, you have to do that on the basis of pretty strong and stable features of the practice. If you're going to propose changes to the practice, you're going to have to do that on the basis of some stable features of the theory that you don't think should be changed, right? So the theory has to be strong enough to challenge the practice, or the practice has to be strong enough to challenge the theory. And those are, of course, decisions you make in thinking about your reader's sense of what is the rational response to this mismatch of the theoretical expectations and the analysis.
So I you've been saying something which is kind of floated underneath what you said, and I think we should just explicate that a little bit. The this thing about doing something interesting, and this idea that doing something interesting means somehow pushing back on the expectations or the assumptions that your reader has. And I there's a great paper called That's Interesting, which talks about like the rhetorical navigation of that, where they say it's about finding that balance between saying something that's not obvious and that's also not absurd. And finding that sweet spot, I think really, it depends on two things at least. It depends on who your reader is. It also depends on the amount of space that you have. How much of your reader's attention do you have to make that? And I think it's just worth saying that when you have these 8,000 words scientific papers, you can do certain things with your reader that you can't, of course, do in a paragraph. And in principle, you can do more in a thesis. Would you elaborate?
I mean, you focus, and again, quite rightly, on this the positive value of being interesting. You should find something interesting. It's a, I mean, it's a pretty big burden to put on yourself, right? As a writer, is I'm going to have to interest this peer reader, so somebody who is largely familiar with the same material. I still have to come up with something interesting within this framework of shared experience, a shared discipline. So that can be quite challenging. It's an important challenge to overcome. What I would say is that the paragraph structure breaks that the problem of being interesting down into more manageable tasks, so you don't have to be as interesting as your entire paper put together. And in fact, if you remember what I said about how you write a paragraph, it doesn't focus so much on what's interesting here, but what's difficult. And that's actually a good proxy for what is interesting for the reader, right? If I'm going to say something that I think is true, right? What's interesting about that statement is going to be somehow, bear upon some difficulty the reader will have in absorbing this, right? That's the source of its interest. If I say something and the reader just goes, yes, thank you, and adopts the point of view that it comes to believe exactly what your key sentence says the moment you say the key sentence, right? You might say, well, that's good in the sense of I've been persuasive or something like this, but obviously it was a very easy thing for the reader to absorb, and so that's actually a marker of it not being all that interesting in its unit size, right? So to find out what's interesting, you have to really find out what is it that the reader needs. What is it the reader needs the paragraph to do now that I've said it, right? How can I help the reader to handle it? There's that famous line in the A Few Good Men. I want the truth. You can't handle the truth, right? Well, this—I mean, there's some truth to the idea of that truths are more or less easy to handle, right? And of course, the truth that Jack Nicholson, the truth that he's alluding to there is quite a difficult one to handle, and but if true, also very interesting.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's
definitely with managerial implications. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's the point. But so the paragraph, in managing the difficulty in each individual paragraph and making sure there is one, so making sure the paragraph actually does engage with a difficulty. Does the reader find it hard to believe? Does the reader find it hard to understand? Or does the reader find it hard to agree with it? You are really getting at the interest of this proposition that you want to deliver. So I think it's a very, when you say be interesting, I think that's a very good way of putting a positive spin on it. I say help the reader with a difficulty, which is, I guess, kind of a focusing on the hard, the negative of it. But if you say, well, that really all you're saying there is that this is what the reader is interested in, right? That's a good positive spin on it, I would say.
I think also it kind of puts a cap on, I mean, you should also kind of lean into the limitations of it. There are things that you could want to say that are going to be absurd to try to say in a certain format, right? If you have a short essay, then you cannot push back on like strongly held beliefs.
Yeah, and I get that, I get that a lot, especially with people who are writing their master's thesis, as they will say to me, the reason this is really hard to write is that I'm saying so many interesting things and explaining them all to the reader who is unprepared is going to be very, very difficult, right? And of course, the analysis of your paper into paragraphs lets you say, well, are these difficulties that I can solve 1 minute at a time in the reader's mind? So given 40 minutes of the reader's attention, 11 minutes of the reader's attention, if it's an 11 paragraph essay, or, you know, 120 minutes of my reader's attention, how many difficulties do I have the space to solve, right? Which sets a limit on how interesting can I be, right? And then, of course, and I think you're probably going to mention this, you're going to say, well, doesn't it depend on who the reader is, because the difficulty will be. But we have to really remember that the reader here is quite well defined, right? There's about 80 people that the reader could be, and I think if we limit it to that, then this problem becomes manageable, just from the point of view of developing our writing.
When you say 80, you mean the cohort, right? The kind of people who've been through the same experience as you. You're not trying to convince the world. You're not trying to necessarily be interesting to your your professor or your supervisor at that point. That's, by the way, where PhDs get so hard, right? You can only kind of try to be interesting to your peers, but your peers are suddenly very different people. Yeah. That's kind of a different discussion.
Yeah, I mean, we can do that. I mean, there's a way of thinking about that in terms of philosophy of science. Thomas Kuhn was really, I think, really good at this. He's the guy with the paradigm shifts, which might be a useful concept in any case. But he just pointed out that a scientific discipline is about 20 to 100 people whose names you know. They work in particular places and so forth, right? So paradigms that, and so what he really said is a scientific revolution, so-called, really happens in the mind of, you know, some 20, 30, 40 people. And if you know who they are, you also know to whom you are interesting.
Yeah. And you can almost like get a picture of them, hang it on your computer and say, I'm talking to so and so, right? Anyway.
Exactly. And in really good disciplines, you can get a group photo of them.
Because they all meet at a conference.
They meet at a conference, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about the structure of the of an academic paper. And the reason that we kind of do that is, of course, because that's helpful. I think, as a side note, that it's also actually helpful to know when you're reading social science papers that these are the moves that the author is trying to take you through. I find that mm-hmm. when I recently, after or in a connection with having taken your course when I was younger, I revisited my old compendiums from my studies, and I looked at them and I was like, I'm highlighting all the wrong things, right? I highlighted in the background section because I thought that was, there were so many interesting things there. And then I thought the author's analysis wasn't really interesting often. And now when I revisit them, of course, I think the analysis is the interesting part. But I think that's just kind of helpful to know what's the author trying to do at different moments in the paper. That's kind of helpful to think about. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I think there's an important point to be made. There is that one of the things that you're doing as a writer is pretending to be part of this community of knowers. And one of the things that's useful to do as a reader is also to pretend that, or as a student reader, right, is that you pretend to be qualified to understand this paper, and then really just say there's some information that I'm getting in the background section. But I'm just going to learn that, right? And then the important thing is that I receive the theory section as though I'm on the same page, though I'm in the same level. So I think it's a good shift to make that it's not just the paper wasn't written to teach you the things you're actually learning from it, right? That wasn't the intention of the paper. The paper is actually, if you're reading a scientific paper as a student, the paper is written to communicate with other people who know much of this stuff. And you are learning it from this paper, but then you need to go back and read that paper from the point of view of somebody who already knows a lot of these things in order to understand what it's really trying to say to you.
So I think...
One last thing is that because a lot of these papers we're reading are historical, even the analysis is no longer current, right, in that sense. So you have to kind of remind yourself, okay, at the time that this paper was written, this was an unknown fact, this data was not available to the other researchers, and so you read it with that. You try to read it within the structure of the theory as presented in the theory section, not the theory as we know it today, which has already learned this lesson from the.
So, for instance, March 91 was right in 91.
Right.
Today, it's not right in the same way.
Exactly.
And that's just kind of a nice caveat. When you have those seven sections, the introduction, the background, the theory, the method, the analysis, the discussion, and the conclusion, you have a point of view on structuring that, like how many paragraphs, how many words go into each. Would you share that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say background, theory, method, and discussion are about the same size. The introduction and the conclusion should be together the same size as the theory section. So a good way of just doing this is in terms of take 40 parts.
40 paragraphs?
Yeah, 40 paragraphs in all. So you're going to have 3 paragraphs of introduction and 2 paragraphs of conclusion. But if you have 80 paragraphs, you'll probably have 6 paragraphs in the introduction and 4 paragraphs in the conclusion. Then your background section will be 5 paragraphs out of 40. Your theory section will be 5 paragraphs out of 40, and your method section will be 5 paragraphs out of 40. Those are ballpark figures, and you are always entitled to think about, okay, the theory is more complicated, I need it to be a bit longer. The method is very straightforward, I just need to explain what I did. And background, likewise, you make similar decisions. The discussion should also be about 5 paragraphs. Which is to say about the same length as the theory in the background. and that's, of course, because if you have practical or theoretical, if your implications are pushing back against what you've said in the background and the theory. So it's got the complexity. You've actually set up a space in which to have a discussion in your background and theory section. And so you're going to respect that by having the discussion roughly the same length. And then the analysis... Again, ballpark figure, 3 times as long as the theory section.
To make sure that you're actually bringing something to the table.
Exactly.
That you use all that setup for something.
That's right. And the analysis covers the thing that should really have been the hardest part of your project, right? Is that it was not thinking up your method, not justifying your method, not describing what you did, like not developing the method, but actually carrying out the interviews. Actually, I mean that, or the on-site observations, or gathering the data and analyzing it and so forth, right? So all of that is the real meat of the paper. You just want to make sure proportionally that that is made clear. It's also where the reader, I mean, it's where you have complete authority, actually, because you know what your data says. You can make your data publicly available, but you should always write your paper as though the reader will not see the data firsthand. The reader is relying on you to report the data accurately. And that's why it needs more space.
I think this is the way that I've found this helpful, actually, is because this is how I like using that structure is how I wrote most of my PhD and how I write most papers now. And for me, it's super helpful for the following reason. And you can push back on the formalism, right? Basically, this gave me a way to write a standard social science paper in 2 weeks, right? So Monday of the first week, I would write the introduction and the conclusion. Then that would take me 2.5 hours. Then I would spend the last half hour writing five key sentences for the background. Then on Tuesday, I would write the background section and five and then outline for the theory section. And then, I'd keep doing that. So Tuesday, I'd write the background. Wednesday, I'd write the theory. Thursday, I'd write the method. Friday, I'd rewrite the introduction and the conclusion to make sure I was on the ball, right? And on Monday, I would also outline the first section of my analysis, right? Then Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I'd write the analysis. Thursday, I'd write the discussion. And Friday, I would rewrite the introduction, the conclusion again, right? So, and when I tell PhD students this, they're blown away. Of course, you have to have learned a lot of stuff, right? You have to know everything. When on Monday at 8 o'clock, actually, you have to know it the day before because you have to have outlined. But that's a, I think, a super powerful way to think about it, and it's a way to think about writing your bachelor thesis in a month, and that month is not a stressful month. It's a month where you prioritize your time, set time aside, but you're working in the morning, you have the afternoons off, you can do other things, you can restore yourself, relax. And then, but still, you can get, I mean, this is tremendously productive.
Hemingway has that great line. He says, "I always live a hell of a healthy life for the first 5 hours of every day." And that's so if you do that, if you get up in the morning, do your exercises, eat a healthy meal, so forth, sit down, write for 3 hours, then you're getting this kind of work done. One of the things you're doing, which is very, very good, is you're returning to the introduction, so you and conclusion, right? You're taking that, you're starting with it, then you're in the middle, you're returning to it, and then in the end, you're returning to it as well. If I'm doing the math right, and because you're adding these extra activities like outlining and rewriting parts of it, that accounts for the fact that you're spending 2 times 15 hours, 30 hours, right, in those 2 weeks, doing where the core work actually takes only 20 hours of writing the paragraphs, the 40 paragraphs. So that makes all that makes really good sense, and I think it's a really great approach. One thing that I could suggest, which would be different, and for some people might be a little might be useful as well, is to work through it in two passes, to hold back. So instead of finishing the background section, writing all the paragraphs in a single day, you go through what I call the 9 plus 11 hour challenge, right? So you do 9 hours of work, then you do 11 hours of work. The first 9 hours writes 18 paragraphs, the introduction, and only one paragraph from your conclusion, two paragraphs from the theory, two from the method, two from the analysis. Sorry, two from background, two from theory, two from method, two from analysis. Sorry, six for analysis and two for discussion. So you work through the entire paper, but then there's holes in it. And then you go back. And that can be a good way of making sure that already in the first week, you've got really something for all of the paper. You've got a kind of a view of the whole thing. And then the next week, you're going to go and you're going to fill that in which is so if some people will prefer to do it your way and just get, start at the beginning and go to the end. Others will want to get through it once and then go through it again.
When again, now we're gonna kind of deep dive into the formalism, right? I know that you have a point of view on how those different sections should be connected, right? So the introduction should do certain things. It should summarize essentially different parts of the paper, and the conclusion should also summarize different parts. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you can look at the introduction as starting with the world. In the paragraph one, you introduce the world. In paragraph two, you introduce the science, the discipline that we're working within, or in a certain sense, the theory. And so by that time, by paragraphs one and two, we've already introduced the theory and the method. Oh, sorry, the background and the theory. Then in the paragraph three, you've got a lot of work to do because you're going to introduce the rest, right? And the conclusion is actually captured in the "this paper shows that" key
Which,
sentence. So the key sentence of paragraph three says, "This paper shows that." And as soon as you recognize that it's that the purpose of the paragraph isn't to support, elaborate, or defend what you're going to show, but the fact that you're going to show it, you realize, okay, well, now my job is to describe a paper that would show that. Which means I have to say it is written on the basis of 27 semi-structured interviews with managers and blah, blah, blah. And they say this and that. So you're summarizing first the method, then you're summarizing the analysis, and then you say this has profound implications for how innovation is managed in major international corporations. And you obviously outline those implications, which is to say you introduce your introduction. So if you think of the introduction as doing the work of introducing the paper without obsessing about in this section of the paper, in this section I will, but you really say I have to get through all of it, I have to move through all of the different parts, then I think you have a very strong way of thinking the relationship between the introduction and the other sections. Now, you also said, what is the connection between the different sections, right? And we can do too much work explicitly connecting them. But even just calling them the background section, the theoretical expectations or the theoretical framework section. So you're providing a background, you're then providing a frame, right? You're then suggesting the basis on which you collected your data. So you've now got background, you've got a frame, you've got a basis, right? You're then going to have the data, and of course, data. What's data in Greek? Actually, just means given. What is that which is given, right? So once you've got this setup where you've got a background, frame, and a basis, you're now going to be given some content, right? And then, of course, in the discussion, what are you doing? You're discoursing, right? You're moving about in this thing. And so, if you think of it as a structure in which certain intellectual activities go on, then I would very much prefer to leave a lot of those connections between the sections implicit. Think of it as one big machine that's working rather than parts that are connected in that kind of way, if possible.
And the conclusion has something to do with the paragraph three, the
Exactly.
third paragraph of the introduction as well.
So if you think about how am I going to write the conclusion, a good way of doing it is say the first paragraph is going to be at the highest possible intellectual level that you are that the paper will be at. This is where the reader has now arrived, has understood everything you're going to say, has all the information that you are going to provide to the reader. And you're now going to assume that the reader either gets it or not, which is to say you're going to say it the way you say it to yourself. And what you're going to say is everything that came after this paper shows that. So you're now going to, you're not, you've already shown it. The paper has already shown this, but you're now going to point directly at the thing you've shown, right? In clear and direct language, without apologies, without too many caveats. All your limitations are a part of the paper, right? So you can say it straight out, and you can assume your methods are good, and you can assume that the analysis is sound. And so now you just say what you've shown, right? And then, of course, in the very last paragraph, you describe, you return either to the world or the science, paragraph 1 and 2, and you describe the situation we now are left in, either as practitioners or as theorists. Given that this thing in paragraph 39 or whatever it is, the second to last paragraph, is true, what kind of world are we now living in, or what kind of scientific activity is now relevant? What sort of science? What's the state of the art now?
So I'm going to suggest a hyperformalist way of approaching this, which is going to be dreary to read, but nonetheless helpful. Right. So at the beginning of every paper is an abstract, which is not part of the 40 paragraphs that make it up, right? So I would say that that abstract, and I think you should write this before you start writing anything in the paper, right? You need one sentence that's going to summarize everything that you say in 1,000 words about the background. You should do that in one sentence. Then follow that, you should have one sentence that summarizes your 1,000 words of theory. Then you should have one sentence summarizing all your methods. Then you should have three sentences that summarize your analysis, one sentence that summarizes your implications, and you should do all of that in less than 200 words. So this is really the super key sentences. And basically, then what you can do is that you can take that first sentence of your abstract and you can say, this is going to be the key sentence for my first paragraph of my introduction. The second sentence that you have on theory is going to be your key sentence for your background section, or scratch that. The second sentence of your abstract is going to be the second paragraph key sentence in your introduction. The method section is that one sentence you have should basically be something that you can elaborate throughout your method section. And you should be able to, you should, and you can basically continue this,
Right,
right?
and exactly, and that will actually be maybe the second sentence of paragraph 3, because you're going to say it is based on your state of method. Now, I agree with this, and let me just say I agree with it in principle,
In principle,
right? Because I think it's very, very useful to think of your paper as something that can be rigorously formalized, right? So that you can really say how do the claims connect logically in the structure? I think that's a very important exercise. I'm not sure that I would recommend writing the, or actually, let me just, I am sure I would not recommend writing the abstract first in any kind of committed way. It's fine to say, I'm going to write an abstract, I'm going to take 27 minutes, just write it. And then I'll write the introduction and I'll move on from there. I would say it's unnecessary to write the abstract if you're going to write the introduction in a formalized way anyway at the beginning, right? And I think a lot of people will, for a lot of people, doing all this preparatory outlining, preparatory structuring, that's the thing that keeps them from starting. So the first,
That's fair.
the thing I want to say is make yourself a plan where you're writing one or two paragraphs that actually belong in the paper, in the body of the paper, not even in the introduction and conclusion, right? So your plan for the day will always include one or two paragraphs that are
Agreed.
actual
Absolutely.
bread
Yes.
and butter, meat and potatoes,
Building blocks,
bolognese sauce,
foundations, yeah.
whatever. The heavy part of the paper, right? The actual building blocks. And then, of course, you can spend some time every day or every other day or every week reflecting on these larger structural issues. But it's really, really important not to say, I'm not going to write the 17th paragraph which will be down in the theory section, whatever, until I have resolved all the big structural issues. That's a killer, and you just don't want to do that. What you want to do is just be doing things. And I think this is actually true of all things. I know a lot of people who work in with business processes and marketing processes and innovative processes, where they'll say, well, you've got to be doing something every day. There's got to be something you're doing that's actually the activity. Because otherwise you're not. Otherwise, you are really just procrastinating. It feels like thinking, but it is just putting things
I
off.
agree, absolutely. I think this is just a, when I say this, I don't mean it as a replacement. I mean it as like when you're sitting down and you're going to write that paper, write that thesis. It can be kind of a helpful way. But that, of course, presumes that you can say things in the level of detail that you would do in a, let's call it bread and butter kind of paragraph. If you can't say it in that detail, all these other things don't make sense.
And that's it's why I think of it as something you're doing in principle, and think of it as a high quality, a really high quality paper or thesis you're writing will look like it
This was the case.
resulted from this sort of pre-planning and this kind of thing, right? It will have that. Well, but it is an illusion because it's always going to have been made by a much messier process that where the result then has been structured in such a way, right? This is why I always say, you have to remember that some people claim to be able to bend spoons with their minds, but it's an illusion, and what you're really doing is you're hiding the manual labor from the audience, and then it looks like something else is going on, right?
I think that's a good way of thinking about it. It's always messy, of course, but and the reason I say this is to exactly just to give people a way of thinking about what is it that you're trying to do. And I think it should be taken that way, right? So it can be too formalistic. And listening to a pianist just doing scales sucks, right? But it can be kind of a helpful way to get people started at
Absolutely.
thinking
There's,
of.
and we really have to keep that straight, that there's no shame in having you in your there's no shame in your text at the end being much more orderly than the process that produced it. That's just never be ashamed of that, right? And it will always be the case if you are giving yourself 27 minutes to produce a 1 minute moment of your reader's experience, right? Because then there will always be things that you're concealing from the reader, and just get used to that, and don't worry about it, and then sort of enact or even, I mean, it's fine to say pretend to be more coherent in your writing than you may actually be in real life.
Yeah, I mean, we all enjoy movies without the bloopers, right?
Right.
It'd be a pain to watch it with all the bloopers. Anyway,
Exactly. Yeah.
so I think we've kind of talked about scaling up
Yep.
from the standard social science paper, 40 paragraphs, up to a longer thing. Now, something that's going to be real in the course too is an essay, right? A shorter essay on the order of 5 pages, which, by the kind of rule of thumb, is going to be, 10 paragraphs,
Right.
right? And that's a good way of thinking about an essay. You're saying 10 things
Yes.
and justifying them. Could you just kind of in closing give us a sense of how would you think about a structure for a 10 paragraph essay?
Right.
Assume that it's a loosely structured assignment that is given some input. It could be a podcast, an interview with some business person, for instance. And then you're going to do something with that. Having come to the end of the course, having mastered a certain set of ideas, how would you think about those 2,000 words, 10 paragraphs?
Right. So the structure that we talked about for a three-paragraph introduction, when you get down to around 5 pages, you don't want to spend 3 paragraphs. That's a page and a half just introducing. So you have to find a way of kind of telescoping that content down. And the way you do it is you say, well, I'm going to write two paragraph or two sorry two sentences about the world in which we live as a start. I'm going to then immediately within the same paragraph segue to the theory. And the reason I'm doing this is to set myself up with a key sentence, which now is this paper shows that still. That's still the key sentence of this paragraph. But
But it's
what
just
I,
the first paragraph,
but it's the
not the
very,
third.
exactly, but now it's the first paragraph. And what I've done is I've said I'm going to elaborate what this paper shows, including the framing, the theoretical and the real world framing of this, right? So I'm actually motivating why I'm going to show this. And then I'm only going to have one sentence, or it'll be maybe one or two sentences, that allows me to do everything that includes it is based on, like what it is based on, and so the methodology and the implications. But usually, you won't say, I will show in a short essay like that. You'll say, I will argue. Usually you won't have a method because really you're just being, you've just been, let's say you have been given a podcast interview with somebody to analyze. Well, the method was listening to it, right?
In
So
sort of a
they,
common
yeah.
sense way, or rather an informed way, but you're not going to do something specific
Exactly. It's going to be
methodologically.
framed by their theory. So you'll be spending more time with the theory. And maybe even the background section won't be that important either because you're going to just cover, you're just going to say something about this person. So you'll have maybe one paragraph of background or something like that. You'll have some theory and then you'll have some analysis. So what you're really doing is you're saying, well, how much of this can I just move into the introduction? How much of it can I move out of the paper altogether and just assume as basis? Again, think about this idea that the data is what is given, right? Well, if you're given a case, right, well, you don't have
That's
a
it.
right, you don't have to explain how you know what method you're using to analyze the case. So that simplifies things quite a bit. But I would still argue that you should think of the paragraphs as each saying one thing, supporting, elaborating, or defending. And then again, when you get to the last paragraph, you again have to decide. I'm gonna probably still do the summarizing in the sense of I'm gonna state the conclusion. Not as I have here argued that, but I'm just going to say it. So I'm going to arrive at that moment that is the highest possible intellectual level for my paper. Just like we talked about before. But now I'm also probably within the same paragraph going to have to say what kind of world do we then live in where this is true, right? So the paragraph is going to both say it is true and absorb the impact of that truth for the world or the discipline that we're working in. So yeah, it's a question of usually removing a lot of background and method, and then of course removing a lot of paragraphs in general. You'll still have most of it will be analysis, hopefully. The substance of the paper will be analysis. And you'll still have some discussion and conclusion, but some of it may be merged into a single paragraph. So you're reducing your three paragraph introduction to one, you're reducing your two paragraph conclusion to two, you're removing the method. You are still going to do some background and theory, probably, and you'll leave your major space for the analysis.
So I'm just going to summarize that. I
Yeah.
just wrote it down, right? So there's going to be an introduction. Often they'll say, I will argue that, right? That's going to be the key
But
sentence.
that sentence will come halfway through the
Yeah,
paragraph.
it'll come pretty far down because you'll spend the first half of that paragraph saying some things about background and some things about theory in
Yes.
pretty brief terms,
Yes.
right? Then you might your second paragraph might be an elaborated background. Right, where you're going to kind of explain what did I get from this
Yeah.
input that we received as a community of a cohort
Right.
of students, right? How did I make sense of what did I notice? Then you're going to have maybe one or two paragraphs, like this is paragraph three, maybe four of the theory, where you're going to present the way that you're going to understand this, right? Then you're going to have paragraphs 5 to 8, right? There's going to be four paragraphs where you're going to be doing the analytical work. If you have only one theory paragraph, it'll be longer. But basically, 5 to 8 is going to be analysis. 9 would be some kind of discussion, maybe, where you could introduce different ways of seeing, contradictions with the rest of the material that we read, possibly empirical limitations. There might be more to it. The person you're interviewing might be lying. I don't know. You could have all kinds of justified ideas about that. And then one paragraph at the end, paragraph 10, basically the conclusion. That's kind of a helpful way of thinking about it. All right. Thank you, Thomas, for this dive into practice, and thank you for so generously accepting my hyper-formalization of your ideas.
I think let's end it on that note that that those hyperformalizations are really good in principle. And what I would encourage our students, our listeners, to do, especially since this is an entirely auditory experience, right, is to sit down after having listened to this and map out, just in rough outline, a 40-paragraph paper, an 11-paragraph paper, an 80-paragraph dissertation. Just to see if you're imagining the same thing that we've been talking about. So we've been talking about it reasonably strictly. Certainly, if you sit down and listen to it again and try to draw pictures of what we've been saying, I think that might be useful. But even just as a memory exercise, just think, well, what were these objects that they were describing? What is a 40 paragraph paper? What is an 80 paragraph thesis? What is an 11 paragraph essay? Just in terms of paragraph structure, right? Because we have been answering those questions.
Excellent. Thank you. Again, I wish we had a
Thank you.
jingle.
I next time we'll have a jingle.
We'll
We'll come up
try
with a
to do a
jingle.
jingle. All
Yeah.
right.
Yes.
Thank you.